of this horrible deed. Tell you because you are a Jew.
Could there be some kind of horror unknown to us? All the atrocities and tortures that a sick brain can invent are familiar to me. I have felt them on my own body, and I have seen them happen in the camp. Any story that this sick man had to tell couldn't surpass the horror stories which my comrades in the camp exchanged with each other at night. I wasn't really curious about his story, and inwardly I only hoped the nurse had remembered to tell an askari where I was. Otherwise they would be looking for me. Perhaps they would think I had escaped. I was uneasy. I could hear voices outside the door, but I recognized one as the nurse's voice, and that reassured me. The strangled voice went on.
Some time elapsed before I realized what guilt I had incurred.
I stared at the bandaged head. I didn't know what he wanted to confess, but I knew for sure that after his death a sunflower would grow on his grave. Already a sunflower was turning toward the window through which the sun was sending its rays into this death chamber. Why was the sunflower already making its appearance? Because it would accompany him to the cemetery, stand on his grave, and sustain his connection with life. And this I envied him. I envied him also because in his last moments he was able to think of a live mother who would be grieving for him.
I was not born a murderer,
he wheezed. He breathed heavily and was silent.
I come from Stuttgart, and I am now 21. That is too soon to die. I have had very little out of life.
Of course it is too soon to die, I thought. But did the Nazis ask whether our children, whom they were about to gas, had ever had anything out of life? Did they ask whether it was too soon for them to die? Certainly nobody had ever asked me the question. As if he had guessed my mental reaction, he said,
I know what you are thinking, and I understand. But may I not still say that I am too young?
Then, in a burst of calm coherency, he went on.
My father, who was a manager of a factory, was a convinced social democrat. After 1933, he got into difficulties, but that happened to many. My mother brought me up as a Catholic. I was actually a server in the church and a special favorite of our priest, who hoped I would one day study theology. But it turned out differently. I joined the Hitler Youth, and that, of course, was the end of the church for me. My mother was very sad, but finally stopped reproaching me. I was her only child. My father never uttered a word on the subject. He was afraid lest I should talk in the Hitler Youth about what I had heard at home. Our leader demanded that we should champion our cause everywhere, even at home. He told us that if we heard anyone abuse it, we must report to him. There were many who did so, but not I. My parents nevertheless were afraid, and they stopped talking when I was near. Their mistrust annoyed me, but, unfortunately, there was no time for reflection in those days. In the Hitler Youth, I found friends and comrades. My days were full. After school, most of our class hurried to the clubhouse or sports ground. My father rarely spoke to me, and when he had something to say, he spoke cautiously and with reserve. I know now what depressed him. Often I watched him sitting in his armchair for hours, brooding, without saying a word. When the war broke out, I volunteered, naturally in the SS. I was far from being the only one in my troop to do so. Almost half of them joined the forces voluntarily, without a thought, as if they were going to a dance or on an outing. My mother wept when I left. As I closed the door behind me, I heard my father say, "They are taking our son away from us. No good will come of it." His words made me indignant. I wanted to go back and argue with him. I wanted to tell him that he simply did not understand modern times. But I let it be, so as not to make my departure worse for all of us by an ugly scene. Those words were the last I ever heard my father speak. Occasionally he would add a few lines to my mother's letter, but my mother usually made excuses by saying he was not back from work, and she was anxious to catch the post.
He paused and groped with his hand for the glass on the night table. Although he could not see it, he knew where it was. He drank a mouthful of water and put the glass back safely in its place before I could do it for him. Was he really in such a bad way as he had said?
We were first sent to a training camp at an army base where we listened feverishly to the radio messages about the Polish campaign. We devoured the reports in the newspapers and dreaded that our services might not, after all, be needed. I was longing for experience, to see the world, to be able to recount my adventures. My uncle had had such exciting tales to tell of the war in Russia, how they had driven Ivan into the Masurian lakes. I wanted to play my part in that sort of thing.
I sat there, like a cat on hot bricks, and tried to release my hand from his. I wanted to go away, but he seemed to be trying to talk to me with his hands as well as his voice. His grip grew tighter, as if pleading with me not to desert him. Perhaps his hand was a replacement for his eyes. I looked around the room, and glancing at the window, I saw a part of the sun-drenched courtyard, with the shadow of the roof crossing it obliquely, a boundary between light and dark, a defined boundary without any transition. Then the dying man told of his time in occupied Poland, mentioning a place. Was it Rzeszów? I didn't ask. Why the long prelude? Why didn't he say what he wanted from me? There was no necessity to break it so gently. Now his hand began to tremble, and I took the opportunity to withdraw mine, but he clutched it again and whispered, "Please." Did he want to fortify himself, or me, for what was to come?
And then? Then came the terrible thing. But first, I must tell you a little more about myself.
He seemed to detect my uneasiness. Had he noticed I was watching the door? For suddenly, he said,
"No one will come in. The nurse promised to keep watch out there. Heinz, my schoolmate, who was with me in Poland too, always called me a dreamer. I didn't really know why. Perhaps because I was always merry and happy. At least until that day came, and it happened. It's a good thing that Heinz cannot hear me now. My mother must never know what I did. She must not lose her image of a good son. That is what she always called me. She must always see me as she wanted to see me. She used to read my letters out to all the neighbors, and the neighbors said that they were proud I got my wound fighting for the Führer and the Fatherland. You know the usual phrase."
His voice grew bitter, as if he wanted to hurt himself, give himself pain.
"In my mother's memory, I am still a happy boy without a care in the world, full of high spirits. Oh, the jokes we used to play."
As he recalled his youth and comrades, I too thought back on the years when practical jokes were a hobby of mine. I thought of my old friends, my schoolmates in Prague. We had had many a joke together, we who were young, with life stretching before us. But what had my youth in common with his? Were we not from different worlds? Where were the friends from my world? Still in camp, or already in a nameless mass grave? And where are his friends? They are alive, or at least they have a sunflower on their graves, and a cross with their name on it. And now I began to ask myself why a Jew must listen to the confession of a dying Nazi soldier. If he had really rediscovered his faith in Christianity, then a priest should have been sent for, a priest who could help him die in peace. If I were dying, to whom should I make my confession, if indeed I had anything to confess? And anyway, I would not have as much time as this man had. My end would be violent, as had happened to millions before me. Perhaps it would be an unexpected surprise. Perhaps I would have no time to prepare for the bullet. He was still talking about his youth as if he were reading aloud, and the only effect was that it made me think of my youth, too. But it was so far away that it seemed unreal. It seemed as if I had always been in prison camps, as though I were born merely to be maltreated by beasts in human shape who wanted to work off their frustrations and racial hatreds on defenseless victims. Remembrance of time past only made me feel weak, and I badly needed to remain strong, for only the strong in these dire times had a hope of survival. I still clung to the belief that the world one day would revenge itself on these brutes, in spite of their victories, their jubilation at the battles they had won, and their boundless arrogance. The day would surely come when the Nazis would hang their heads as the Jews did now. All my instincts were against continuing to listen to this deathbed disavowal. I wanted to get away. The dying man must have felt this, for he dropped the letter and groped for my arm. The movement was so pathetically helpless that all of a sudden I felt sorry for him. I would stay, although I wanted to go. Quietly he continued talking.
Last spring, we saw that something was afoot. We were told time after time we must be prepared for great doings. Each of us must show himself a man. He must be tough. There was no place for humanitarian nonsense. The Führer needed real men. That made a great impression on us at the time. When the war with Russia began, we listened over the radio to a speech by Himmler before we marched out. He spoke of the final victory of the Führer's mission, on smoking out subhumans. We were given piles of literature about the Jews and the Bolsheviks. We devoured the Stürmer, and many cut caricatures from it and pinned them above our beds. But that was not the sort of thing I cared for. In the evenings in the canteen, we grew heated with beer and talk about Germany's future. As in Poland, the war with Russia would be a lightning campaign, thanks to the genius of our leader. Our frontiers would be pushed further and further eastward. The German people needed room to live.
For a moment he stopped, as though exhausted.
You can see for yourself on what sort of career my life was launched.
He was sorry for himself. His words were bitter and resigned. I again looked through the window and perceived that the boundary between light and shadow was now above the other windows of the inner facade. The sun had climbed higher. One of the windows caught the sun's rays and reflected them as it was closed again. For a moment, the flash of light looked like a heliographic signal. At that time, we were ready to see symbols in everything. It was a time rife for mysticism and superstition. Often my fellow prisoners in the camp told ghost stories. Everything for us was unreal and insubstantial. The earth was peopled with mystical shapes. God was on leave, and in his absence others had taken over, to give us signs and hints. In normal times we would have laughed at anybody who believed in supernatural powers, but nowadays we expected them to intervene in the course of events. We devoured every word spoken by alleged soothsayers and fortune-tellers. We often clung to completely nonsensical interpretations if only they gave us a ray of hope for better times. The eternal optimism of the Jew surpassed all reason, but now even reason was out of place. What in this Nazi world was reasonable and logical? You lost yourself in fantasy merely in order to escape from the appalling truth, and in such circumstances, reason would have been a barrier. We escaped into dreams, and we didn't want to awake from those dreams. I forgot for a moment where I was, and then I heard a buzzing sound. A bluebottle, probably attracted by the smell, flew around the head of the dying man, who could not see it, nor could he see me wave it away.
Thanks,
he nevertheless whispered. And for the first time, I realized that I, a defenseless subhuman, had contrived to lighten the lot of an equally defenseless Superman, without thinking, simply as a matter of course. The narration proceeded.
At the end of June, we joined a unit of storm troops. and were taken to the front in trucks. We drove past vast fields of wheat, which stretched as far as the eye could see. Our platoon leader said that Hitler had intentionally started the campaign against Russia at a time which would enable us to bring in the harvest. We thought that clever. On our endless journey, we saw by the wayside dead Russians, burnt-out tanks, broken-down trucks, dead horses. And there were wounded Russians, too, lying there helpless, with nobody to care for them. All the way we could hear their screams and groans. One of my comrades spat at them, and I protested. He simply replied with a phrase that our officer had used, "No pity for Ivan." His words sounded like a sober military command. He spoke in the style of a war correspondent. His words were parrot-like, unthinking. His conversation was full of stupid phrases which he had taken from newspapers. Finally, we came to a Ukrainian village, and here I had my first contact with the enemy. We shot up a deserted farmhouse in which Russians had barricaded themselves. When we stormed in, we found only a few wounded men lying about with whom we did not bother. That is, I did not bother. But our platoon leader gave them the coup de grace. Since I have been in hospital here, these details constantly recur to me. I live it all over again, but much more precisely and vividly. Now I have plenty of time. The fighting was inhuman. Many of us could hardly stand it. When our major saw this, he shouted at us, "Believe you me, do you think the Russians act differently toward our men? You need only see how they treat their own people. The prisons we come across are full of murdered men. They simply mow down their prisoners when they cannot take them away. He who has been selected to make history cannot be bothered with such trifles." One evening a comrade took me aside in order to express his horror, but after the very first sentence he stopped. He did not trust me. We continued to make history. Day after day we heard victory reports, and constantly we were told that the war would soon be over. Hitler said so, and Himmler. For me, it is now really over.
He took a deep breath, then a sip of water. Behind me I heard a noise and looked around. I had not noticed that the door was open, but he had heard it.
"Sister, please."
"All right, I only wanted to look round." She shut the door again.
One hot summer day, we came to Dnipropetrovsk. Everywhere there were abandoned cars and guns, many of them still intact. Obviously the Russians had left in great haste. Houses were burning, and the streets were blocked by hastily erected barricades, but there was nobody left to defend them. There were deaths among the civilians. On the pavement I saw the body of a woman, and over her crouched two weeping children. When the order came to fall out, we leaned our rifles against the house walls, sat down and smoked. Suddenly, we heard an explosion and looked up, but there was no plane in sight. Then we saw a whole block of houses had blown up. Many house blocks had been mined by the Russians before they retreated, and as soon as our troops entered, the buildings blew up. One comrade declared that the Russians had learned such tactics from the Finns. I was glad we had been resting. We had escaped again. Suddenly a staff car stopped near us. A major climbed out and sent for our captain. Then came a number of trucks, which took us to another part of the town. There the same miserable picture presented itself. In a large square, we got out and looked around us. On the other side of the square, there was a group of people under close guard. I assumed they were civilians who were to be taken out of the town, in which fighting was still going on. And then the word ran through our group like wildfire. They're Jews. In my young life, I had never seen many Jews. No doubt there had formerly been some, but for the most part they had emigrated when Hitler came to power. The few who remained simply disappeared later. It was said they had been sent to the ghetto. Then they were forgotten. My mother sometimes mentioned our family doctor, who was a Jew, and for whom she mourned deeply. She carefully preserved all his prescriptions, for she had complete trust in his medical knowledge. But one day the chemist told her that she must get her medicines prescribed by a different doctor. He was not allowed to make up the prescriptions of a Jewish doctor. My mother was furious, but my father just looked at me and held his tongue.
I need not tell you what the newspapers said about the Jews. Later in Poland, I saw Jews who were quite different from ours in Stuttgart. At the army base at Debitska, some Jews were still working, and I often gave them something to eat. But I stopped when the platoon leader caught me doing it. The Jews had to clean out our quarters, and I often deliberately left behind on the table some food which I knew they would find. Otherwise, all I knew about the Jews was what came out of the loudspeaker, or what was given us to read. We were told they were the cause of all our misfortunes. They were trying to get on top of us. They were the cause of war, poverty, hunger, unemployment.
I noticed that the dying man had a warm undertone in his voice as he spoke about the Jews. I had never heard such a tone in the voice of an SS man. Was he better than the others? Or did the voices of SS men change when they were dying?
An order was given, he continued, and we marched toward the huddled mass of Jews. There were 150 of them, or perhaps 200, including many children, who stared at us with anxious eyes. A few were quietly crying. There were infants in their mother's arms, but hardly any young men, mostly women and graybeards. As we approached, I could see the expression in their eyes. Fear. Indescribable fear. Apparently they knew what was awaiting them. A truck arrived with cans of petrol, which we unloaded and took into a house. The strong men among the Jews were ordered to carry the cans to the upper stories. They obeyed, apathetically, without a will of their own, like automatons. Then we began to drive the Jews into the house. A sergeant with a whip in his hand helped any of the Jews who were not quick enough. There was a hail of curses and kicks. The house was not very large. It had only 3 stories. I would not have believed it possible to crowd them all into it. But after a few minutes, there was no Jew left on the street.
He was silent, and my heart started to beat violently. I could well imagine the scene. It was all too familiar. I might have been among those who were forced into that house with the petrol cans. I could feel how they must have pressed against each other. I could hear their frantic cries as they realized what was to be done to them. The dying Nazi went on.
Then another truck came up full of more Jews, and they too were crammed into the house with the others. Then the door was locked, and a machine gun was posted opposite.
I knew how this story would end. My own country had been occupied by the Germans for over a year, and we had heard of similar happenings in Bialystok, Brody, and Grodek. The method was always the same. He could spare me the rest of his gruesome account. So I stood up, ready to leave, but he pleaded with me,
"Please stay. I must tell you the rest."
I really do not know what kept me, but there was something in his voice that prevented me from obeying my instinct to end the interview. Perhaps I wanted to hear from his own mouth, in his own words, the full horror of the Nazis' inhumanity.
When we were told that everything was ready, we went back a few yards, and then received the command to remove safety pins from hand grenades and throw them through the windows of the house. Detonations followed one after another. My God!
Now he was silent, and he raised himself slightly from the bed. His whole body was shivering. But he continued.
We heard screams, and saw the flames eat their way from floor to floor. We had our rifles ready to shoot down anyone who tried to escape from that blazing hell. The screams from the house were horrible.
dense smoke poured out and choked us.
His hand felt damp. He was so shattered by his recollection that he broke into a sweat, and I loosened my hand from his grip, but at once he groped for it again and held it tight.
"Please, please," he stammered, "don't go away. I have more to say."
I no longer had any doubts as to the ending. I saw that he was summoning his strength for one last effort to tell me the rest of the story to its bitter end.
"Behind the windows of the second floor, I saw a man with a small child in his arms. His clothes were alight. By his side stood a woman, doubtless the mother of the child. With his free hand, the man covered the child's eyes. Then he jumped into the street. Seconds later, the mother followed. Then from the other windows fell burning bodies. We shot. Oh, God."
The dying man held his hand in front of his bandaged eyes, as if he wanted to banish the picture from his mind.
"I don't know how many tried to jump out of the windows, but that one family I shall never forget, least of all the child. It had black hair and dark eyes."
He fell silent, completely exhausted. The child with the dark eyes he had described reminded me of Eli, a boy from the Lemberg ghetto, 6 years old, with large, questioning eyes, eyes that could not understand, accusing eyes, eyes that one never forgets. The children in the ghetto grew up quickly. They seemed to realize how short their existence would be. For them, days were months, and months were years. When I saw them with toys in their hands, they looked unfamiliar, uncanny, like old men playing with childish things. When had I first seen Eli? When did I talk to him for the first time? I could not remember. He lived in a house near the ghetto gate. Sometimes he wandered right up to the gate. On one occasion I heard a Jewish policeman talking to him, and that is how I knew his name, Eli. It was rare that a child dared to approach the ghetto gate. Eli knew that. He knew it from instinct, without understanding why. Eli is a pet name for Elijah, Eliyahu Hanavi, the prophet. Recalling the very name awoke memories in me of the time when I too was a child. At the Passover Seder, there stood on the table among the dishes a large, ornate bowl of wine, which nobody was allowed to touch. The wine was meant for Eliyahu Hanavi. After a special prayer, one of us children was sent to open the door. The prophet was supposed to come into the room and drink the wine reserved for him. We children watched the door with eyes large with wonder, but of course nobody came. But my grandmother always assured me that the prophet actually drank from the cup, and when I looked into the cup and found that it was still full, she said, "He doesn't drink more than a tear." Why did she say that? Was a tear all that we could offer the prophet Elijah? For countless generations since the Exodus from Egypt, we had been celebrating the Passover in its memory. And from the great event arose the custom of reserving a cup of wine for Eliyahu Hanavi. We children looked on Eliyahu as our protector, and in our fancy, he took every possible form. My grandmother told us that he was rarely recognizable. He might appear in the form of a village peasant, a shopkeeper, a beggar, or even as a child. And in gratitude for the protection that he afforded us, he was given the finest cup in the house at the Seder service, filled with the best wine. But he drank no more than a single tear from it. Little Eli in the ghetto survived miraculously the many raids on the children, who were looked upon as non-working, useless mouths. The adults worked all day outside the ghetto, and it was during their absence that the SS usually rounded up the children and took them away. A few always escaped the body snatchers, for the children learned how to hide themselves. Their parents built hiding holes under the floors, in the stoves, or in cupboards with false walls, and in time they developed a sort of sixth sense for danger, no matter how small they were. But gradually the SS discovered the cleverest hiding places, and they came out the winner in this game of hide-and-seek with death. Eli was one of the last children that I saw in the ghetto. Each time I left the camp for the ghetto, for a period I had an entry permit for it, I looked for Eli. If I saw him, I could be sure that for the moment there was no danger. There was already famine at that time in the ghetto, and the streets were littered with people dying of hunger. The Jewish policeman constantly warned Eli's parents to keep him away from the gate, but in vain. The German policeman at the ghetto gate often gave him something to eat. One day when I entered the ghetto, Eli was not by the gate, but I saw him later. He was standing by a window, and his tiny hand was sweeping up something from the sill. Then his fingers went to his mouth. As I came closer, I realized what he was doing, and my eyes filled with tears. He was collecting the crumbs, which somebody had put out for the birds. No doubt he figured that the birds would find some nourishment outside the ghetto, from friendly people in the city who dare not give a hungry Jewish child a piece of bread. Outside the ghetto gate, there were often women with sacks of bread or flour trying to barter with the inmates of the ghetto, food for clothes, silver plate, or carpets, but there were few Jews left who possessed anything they could barter with. Eli's parents certainly had nothing to offer in exchange for even a loaf of bread. SS group leader Katzmann, the notorious Katzmann, knew that there must still be children in the ghetto, in spite of repeated searches, so his brutish brain conceived a devilish plan. He would start a kindergarten. He told the Jewish council that he would set up a kindergarten if they could find accommodation for it and a woman to run it. Then the children would be looked after while the grown-ups were out at work. The Jews, eternal and incorrigible optimists, took this as a sign of a more humane attitude. They even told each other that there was now a regulation against shooting. Somebody said that he had heard on the American radio that Roosevelt had threatened the Germans with reprisals if any more Jews were killed. That was why the Germans were going to be more humane in the future. Others talked of an international commission, which was going to visit the ghetto. The Germans wanted to show them a kindergarten as proof of their considerate treatment of the Jews. An official from the Gestapo named Engels, a gray-haired man, came with a member of the Jewish council to see for himself that the kindergarten was actually set up in suitable rooms. He said he was sure there were still enough children in the ghetto who would like to use the kindergarten, and he promised an extra ration of food. And the Gestapo did actually send tins of cocoa and milk. Thus, the parents of the hungry children still left were gradually persuaded to send them to the kindergarten. A committee from the Red Cross was anxiously awaited, but it never came. Instead, one morning 3 SS trucks arrived and took all the children away to the gas chambers. And that night, when the parents came back from work, there were heart-rending scenes in the deserted kindergarten. Nevertheless, a few weeks later, I saw Eli again. His instinct had made him stay at home on that particular morning. For me, the dark-eyed child of whom the man in the bed had spoken was Eli. His little face would be stamped on my memory forever. He was the last Jewish child that I had seen. Up to this moment, my feelings toward the dying man had tended toward sympathy. Now all that was past. The touch of his hand caused me almost physical pain, and I drew away. But I still didn't think of leaving. There was something more to come. Of that I was sure. His story must go on. He murmured something which I did not understand. My thoughts were far away, although I was here only to listen to what he was so anxious to tell me. It seemed to me that he was forgetting my presence, just as for a time I had forgotten his. He was talking to himself in a monotone. Sick people, when they are alone, often talk to themselves. Was he continuing the story that he wanted to tell me, or was it something that he would like to tell me, but which he dare not express in comprehensible words? Who knows what he still had to say? Unimaginable. One thing I had learned, no deed was so awful that its wickedness could not be surpassed.
"Yes, I see them plain before my eyes," he muttered.
What was he saying? How could he see them? His head and eyes were swathed in bandages.
"I can see the child, and his father, and his mother,"
he went on. He groaned, and his breath came gasping from his lungs.
"Perhaps they were already dead when they struck the pavement. It was frightful. Screams mixed with volleys of shots. The volleys were probably intended to drown the shrieks. I can never forget. It haunts me. I have had plenty of time to think, but yet perhaps not enough."
Did I now hear shots? We were so used to shooting that nobody took any notice, but I could hear them quite plainly. There was constant shooting in the camp. I shut my eyes, and in my memory I heard and saw all the shocking details. During his narration, which often consisted of short, broken phrases, I could see and hear everything as clearly as if I had been there. I saw the wretches being driven into the house. I heard their screams. I heard them praying for their children, and then I saw them leaping in flames to earth.
"Shortly afterwards we moved on. On the way we were told that the massacre of the Jews was in revenge for the Russian time bombs which had cost us about 30 men. We had killed 300 Jews in exchange. Nobody asked what the murdered Jews had to do with the Russian time bombs. In the evening there was a ration of brandy. Brandy helps one forget. Over the radio came reports from the front, the numbers of torpedoed ships, of prisoners taken, or planes shot down, and the area of the newly conquered territories. It was getting dark. Fired by the brandy, we sat down and began to sing. I too sang. Today I ask myself how I could have done that. Perhaps I wanted to anesthetize myself. For a time I was successful. The events seemed to recede further and further away, but during the night they came back. A comrade who slept next to me was Peter, and he too came from Stuttgart. He was restless in his sleep, tossing to and fro and muttering. I sat up and stared at him, but it was too dark to see his face, and I could only hear him saying, "No, no," and "I won't." In the morning I could see by the faces of some of my comrades that they too had had a restless night, but nobody would talk about it. They avoided each other. Even our platoon leader noticed it. "You and your sensitive feelings. Men, you cannot go on like this. This is war. One must be hard. They are not our people. The Jew is not a human being. The Jews are the cause of all our misfortunes, and when you shoot one of them, it is not the same thing as shooting one of us. It doesn't matter whether it is a man, woman, or child. They are different from us. Without question, one must get rid of them. If we had been soft, we should still be other people's slaves. But the Führer... Yes. You see..."
He began, but did not continue. What had he been going to say? Something perhaps that might be of comfort to himself. Something that might explain why he was telling me his life story. But he did not return to the subject.
"Our rest period did not last long. Toward midday we resumed the advance. We were now part of the storm troops. We mounted the trucks and were transported to the firing line. But here, too, there was not much to be seen of the enemy. He had evacuated villages and small towns, giving them up without a fight. There were only occasional skirmishes as the enemy retreated. Peter was wounded, Karl Heinz killed. Then we had another rest, with time to wash up and to write letters. Talk centered on different subjects, but there was hardly a word said about the happenings in Dnipropetrovsk. I went to see Peter. He had been shot in the abdomen, but was still conscious. He recognized me and looked at me with tears in his eyes. I sat down by him, and he told me he was soon to be taken away to hospital. He said, 'The people in that house,'
You know what I mean.
Then he lost consciousness.
Poor Peter.
He died with the memory of the most dreadful experience of his life.
I now heard footsteps in the corridor. I looked toward the door, which might open at any moment, and stood up. He stopped me.
Do stay. The nurse is waiting outside. Nobody will come in. I won't keep you much longer, but I still have something important to say.
I sat down again unwillingly, but made up my mind to depart as soon as the nurse returned. What could this man still have to tell me? That he was not the only person who had murdered Jews? That he was simply a murderer among murderers? He resumed his soul-searching.
In the following weeks, we advanced toward the Crimea. Rumor had it that there was hard fighting in front of us. The Russians were well entrenched. It wasn't going to be a walkover anymore, but close fighting, man to man.
He paused for breath. The pauses were becoming more frequent. Obviously, he was overtaxing his strength. His breathing was irregular. His throat seemed to dry up. His hand groped for the glass of water. I did not move. He appeared content as long as he was aware of my presence. He found the glass and gulped down some water. Then he sighed and whispered,
"My God! My God!"
Was he talking about God? But God was absent, on leave, as the woman in the ghetto had said. Yet we all needed him. We all longed to see signs of his omnipresence. For this dying man, however, and for his like, there could be no God. The Führer had taken his place, and the fact that their atrocities remained unpunished merely strengthened their belief that God was a fiction, a hateful Jewish invention. They never tired of trying to prove it. But now this man, who was dying here in his bed, was asking for God. He went on.
The fighting in the Crimea lasted for weeks. We had severe losses. Everywhere military cemeteries sprang up. I heard they were well tended, and on every grave were growing flowers. I like flowers. There are many in my uncle's garden. I used to lie on the grass for hours and admire the flowers.
Did he know already that he would get a sunflower when he was buried? The murderer would own something even when he was dead? And I?
We were approaching Taganrog, which was strongly held by Russians. We lay among the hills, barely 100 yards from them. Their artillery fire was incessant. We cowered in our trenches and tried to conquer our fear by drinking from brandy flasks passed from hand to hand. We waited for the order to attack. It came at last, and we climbed out of the trenches and charged. But suddenly I stopped as though rooted to the ground. Something seized me. My hands, which held my rifle with fixed bayonet, began to tremble. In that moment I saw the burning family, the father with the child and behind them the mother, and they came to meet me. No, I cannot shoot at them a second time, the thought flashed through my mind. And then a shell exploded by my side. I lost consciousness. When I woke in hospital, I knew that I had lost my eyesight. My face and the upper part of my body were torn to ribbons. The nurse told me that the surgeon had taken a whole basin full of shell splinters out of my body. It was a miracle that I was still alive. Even now, I am as good as dead.
He sighed. His thoughts were once again centered on himself, and he was filled with self-pity.
The pain became more and more unbearable. My whole body is covered with marks from pain-killing injections. I was taken from one field hospital to another, but they never sent me home. That was the real punishment for me. I wanted to go home to my mother. I knew what my father would say in his inflexible severity. But my mother... she would look at me with other eyes.
I saw that he was torturing himself. He was determined to gloss over nothing. Once again he groped for my hand, but I had withdrawn it some time before and was sitting on it, out of his reach. I did not want to be touched by the hand of death. He sought my pity, but had he any right to pity? Did a man of his kind deserve anybody's pity? Did he think he would find pity if he pitied himself?
"Look," he said, "those Jews died quickly. They did not suffer as I do, though they were not as guilty as I am."
At this I stood up to go, I, the last Jew in his life. But he held me fast with his white, bloodless hand. Whence could a man drained of blood derive such strength?
"I was taken from one hospital to another. They never sent me home, but I told you that before. I am well aware of my condition, and all the time I have been lying here, I have never stopped thinking of the horrible deed at Dnipropetrovsk. If only I had not survived that shell. But I can't die yet, although I have often longed to die. Sometimes I hoped that the doctor would give me an injection to put me out of my misery. I have indeed asked him to put me to sleep, but he has no pity for me, although I know he has released other dying men from their sufferings by means of injections. Perhaps he is deterred by my youth. On the board at the foot of my bed is not only my name, but also my date of birth. Perhaps that keeps him back. So I lie here waiting for death. The pains in my body are terrible, but worse still is my conscience. It never ceases to remind me of the burning house and the family that jumped from the window."
He lapsed into silence, seeking for words. He wants something from me, I thought, for I could not imagine that he had brought me here merely as an audience.
"When I was still a boy, I believed with my mind and soul in God and in the commandments of the church. Then everything was easier. If I still had that faith, I am sure death would not be so hard. I cannot die without coming clean. This must be my confession. But what sort of confession is this? A letter without an answer?"
No doubt he was referring to my silence. But what could I say? Here was a dying man, a murderer, who did not want to be a murderer, but who had been made into a murderer by a murderous ideology. He was confessing his crime to a man who perhaps tomorrow must die at the hands of these same murderers. In his confession there was true repentance, even though he did not admit it in so many words. Nor was it necessary, for the way he spoke, and the fact that he spoke to me, was a proof of his repentance.
"Believe me, I would be ready to suffer worse and longer pains if by that means I could bring back the dead at Dnipropetrovsk. Many young Germans of my age die daily on the battlefields. They have fought against an armed enemy and have fallen in the fight. But I am left here with my guilt. In the last hours of my life, you are with me. I do not know who you are. I only know that you are a Jew. And that is enough."
I said nothing. The truth was that on his battlefield he had also fought against defenseless men, women, children, and the aged. I could imagine them enveloped in flames, jumping from the windows to certain death. He sat up and put his hands together, as if to pray.
"I want to die in peace. And so I need—"
I saw that he could not get the words past his lips. But I was in no mood to help him. I kept silent.
"I know that what I have told you is terrible. In the long nights while I have been waiting for death, time and time again I have longed to talk about it to a Jew and beg forgiveness from him. Only I didn't know whether there were any Jews left. I know that what I am asking is almost too much for you. But without your answer, I cannot die in peace."
Now there was an uncanny silence in the room. I looked through the window. The front of the buildings opposite was flooded with sunshine. The sun was high in the heavens. there was only a small triangular shadow in the courtyard. What a contrast between the glorious sunshine outside and the shadow of this bestial age here in the death chamber. Here lay a man in bed who wished to die in peace, but he could not, because the memory of his terrible crime gave him no rest. And by him sat a man also doomed to die, but who did not want to die, because he yearned to see the end of all the horror that blighted the world. Two men who had never known each other had been brought together for a few hours by fate. One asks the other for help, but the other was himself helpless and able to do nothing for him. I stood up and looked in his direction, at his folded hands. Between them there seemed to rest a sunflower. At last I made up my mind, and without a word, I left the room. The nurse was not outside the door. I forgot where I was, and did not go back down the staircase up which the nurse had brought me. As I used to do in student days, I went downstairs to the main entrance, and it was not until I saw surprised looks from the nurses and doctors that I realized I was taking the wrong way down. But I did not retreat. Nobody stopped me, and I walked through the main door into the open air and returned to my comrades. The sun, at its zenith, was blazing down. My comrades were sitting on the grass, spooning soup out of their mess tins. I, too, was hungry, and just in time to get the last of the soup. The hospital had made us all a present of a meal. But my thoughts were still with the dying SS man. The encounter with him was a heavy burden on me. His confession had profoundly disturbed me. "Where have you been all this time?" asked somebody. I did not know his name. He had been marching beside me the whole way from the camp to the hospital. "I was beginning to think you had made a bolt for it, which would have meant a nice reception for us back in the camp." I did not reply. "Did you get anything?" he asked, as he peered into the empty bread sack, which, like every other prisoner, I carried over my shoulder. He looked at me suspiciously, as to imply, "You've got something, but won't admit it for fear of having to share it with us." I let him think what he liked, and said nothing. "Are you annoyed with me?" he questioned. "No," said I. I didn't want to talk to him. Not at that moment. After a short pause, we resumed work. There seemed to be no end to the containers which we had to empty. The trucks which carried the rubbish to be burnt somewhere in the open kept coming back incessantly. Where did they take all this refuse? But really I did not care. The only thing I desired was to get away from this place. At long last we were told to stop work and to come back the next day to cart away more rubbish. I went cold when I heard this. On the way back to the camp, our guards, the Askaris, didn't seem to be in a singing mood. They marched along beside us in silence and did not even urge us on. We were all tired. Even I, who had spent most of the day in a sick room. Had it really lasted several hours? Again and again my thoughts returned to that macabre encounter. On the footpaths past which we were marching, people were staring at us. I could not distinguish one face from another. They all seemed to be exactly alike, probably because they were all so utterly indifferent to us, in spite of their stares. Anyhow, why should they behave otherwise? They were long since used to the sight of us. Of what concern were we to them? A few might later on suffer the pangs of conscience for gawking at doomed men so callously. We were not walking fast, because a horse and cart in front impeded us. I had time to conjecture that among these people must be many who had once been amused at the day without the Jews in the high school, and I asked myself if it was only the Nazis who had persecuted us. Was it not just as wicked for people to look on quietly and without protest at human beings enduring such shocking humiliation? But in their eyes were we human beings at all? 2 days before, some newcomers at the camp had told us a very sad but also a very characteristic story. 3 Jews had been hanged in public. They were left swinging on the gallows, and a witty fellow had fastened to each body a piece of paper bearing the words, "Kosher meat," The bystanders had split their sides with laughter at this brilliant joke, and there was a constant stream of spectators to share in the merriment. A woman who disapproved of the vile obscenity was promptly beaten up. We all knew that at public executions the Nazis were at pains to encourage large audiences. They hoped thus to terrify the populace and so stifle any further resistance. Of course, they were well aware of the anti-Jewish feeling of most onlookers. These executions corresponded to the bread and circuses of ancient Rome, and the ghastly scenes staged by the Nazis were by no means generally resented. All of us in camp were tireless in describing every detail of the horrors we had witnessed. Some talked as if they had just got home after a circus performance. Perhaps some of those who were now standing on the pavement and gaping at us were people who would gape at gibbeted Jews. I heard laughter. Perhaps the show they were witnessing, a march past of kosher meat, tickled their fancy. At the end of Gordeska Street, we turned left into Yanovska Street, and we were brought to a halt to let a string of crowded tram cars go past. People clung to the doors like bunches of grapes, tired but happy people, struggling to get home to their families, where they would spend the evening together, playing cards, discussing politics, listening to the radio, perhaps even listening to forbidden foreign transmissions. They all had one thing in common. They had dreams and hopes. We, on the other hand, had to attend the evening roll call and perform gymnastic exercises laid down according to the mood of the officer in charge, often doing interminable knee bends until the officer tired of his joke. Or there awaited us the vitamin B exercise, in which hour after hour we had to carry planks through a lane of SS men. Evening work was dubbed vitamins, but unlike the real vitamins, these killed, not cured. If a man was missing at roll call, they would count us over and over again, and then in place of the missing man they would take any 10 of his comrades out of the ranks and execute them, as a deterrent to the other would-be absentees. And the same thing would happen tomorrow, and perhaps the day after tomorrow, until we were all gone. Thoughts of tomorrow made me think of the dying SS man with his bandaged head. Tomorrow, or perhaps the day after tomorrow, he would get his sunflower. For me, tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, perhaps a mass grave waited. Indeed, at any moment the order might come to clear the hut in which I and my comrades slept, or I might be one of the 10 to be selected as a deterrent. One day a rumor ran round the camp that fresh prisoners were arriving from the provinces. If so, there would be no room in our existing huts, and if the camp authorities couldn't raise any new ones, they would make room in another way. Quite a simple matter. They simply liquidated the original prisoners, hut by hut, to make room for the newcomers. It happened every 2 months. It accelerated the natural decrease in our numbers, and the goal of making Galicia and Lemberg Jew-free grew ever nearer. The narrow-fronted houses in Yanovska Street were a dirty gray and showed traces of war damage, bullet marks on the house fronts and windows boarded up, sometimes merely with cardboard. Yanovska Street was one of the most important arteries in Lemberg, and violent fighting had taken place there when the Germans had captured the city. At the end of the rows of houses, we passed once again